Chair calls the committee meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. We don't have a quorum yet, right? So we'll delay on that and on minutes. Representative Scott, are you prepared to proceed on your bill, House File 3566? And I would note also for record and members of the audience that Representative Hosh's bill 3764 has been moved to Wednesday. So if you're sitting tight for that, go get a coffee. Representative Scott, we cannot move the bill yet because we don't have a quorum, but why don't you go ahead and proceed and be heard on the language. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is very simple in nature. What it does, it would add a line, a checkoff box, and a line onto the state income tax form for people to voluntarily pay additional taxes if they wish. And this, the money that would be collected from that would just go into the general fund. With that, I'll take any questions.
Representative Scott, that's the shortest presentation of any bill I've ever heard.
It's pretty simple.
And I've been here 8 sessions. Are there any questions for Representative Scott?
No, I'm not.
There are no questions. So
we can't move it yet. So we're laying it over.
Really?
Okay. Representative Scott, go ahead, and there are no questions. Have a seat. We will take the motion on the bill later. Representative Mullery, is Representative Mullery here? We can do Representative Markert. Representative Markert, are you prepared to proceed on 2894?
What's the forum number?
Thank you.
And where are we at?
Representative Markert, again, we can't move the bill right now without a quorum, so go ahead and proceed and be heard, and we will deal with the motion later.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for moving this bill up. On the agenda, I do have Mr. Ron Harnack, who's the project coordinator with the Red River Watershed Management Board, here to answer any specific detailed questions. What this bill does, it allows watershed districts to, if they have market value of taxable market value of $500 million or more, they may have outstanding loans of $2 million. The current law is $600,000. So for those over $500 million in taxable market value, it moves up the amount of outstanding loans they can have from $600,000 to $2 million. The reason for this is most of those projects are impoundment or water storage projects where they need to acquire land up front, and with the price of land and so forth, this allows for a more aggressive schedule, especially in areas like the Red River Valley where they're looking at diversions and so forth. So that's what the bill does. There's no impact on property taxes. It just it doesn't do anything with the property taxes. It just allows them to have more loans. And I have Mr. Harnack if anyone has a technical question.
Thank you, Mr. You intend Mr. Harnack to testify on this or just take questions?
No, just questions.
Okay, are there questions for members of the committee for Representative Markert or Mr. Harnack? Seeing none, then thank you, Representative Markert. We will take the motion on the bill when we have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Great, okay. Representative Lanning, yours, as I understand, is an informational hearing because we do not have possession of the bill yet. Do you want to go ahead and take the table? We're here on House File 3740.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3740 updates the law with regard to economic development districts. As all of you know, ever since the TIF law was first introduced back in years ago, there have been a number of changes in TIF law along the way. And one of the problems that cities, communities have had with the current law is that because the tax increment financing district has become more restrictive, it has created a problem in being able to do what communities need to do in a redevelopment district. And so we want to de-link the TIF requirements on blight. with the Economic Development District. And so we have a couple of folks who can talk about the particulars here. Mr. Steve Bubo from the firm of Kennedy and Graven will first of all address the issue.
Go ahead, Mr. Bubo. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Steve Bubo, Kennedy and Graven Law Firm, on behalf of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota. Thank you for having us. I'll try to just briefly describe the purpose of this bill, which is really to create what's kind of a technical problem in the Economic Development Authority statute. That statute was enacted back in 1986, created the possibility of creating economic development authorities that do various kinds of development, redevelopment activities. One of the anomalies is that it authorized EDAs to create what are called economic development districts, which is not to be confused with a TIF district of the same name. That's a different kind of district. This is more of a planning area, very similar to HRAs create redevelopment projects and cities create development districts. These are kind of more broad geographic areas within which their activities occur. But one of the oddities of this bill, of the existing statute, is that the law requires that when you create an economic development district, you have to make a findings that more than 50% of the buildings in that district are substandard, which is the same test as for redevelopment TIF districts. And again, this is supposed to be the big planning area. And then many of the powers that EDAs have to do things like buy land, sell land, have to be done within an economic development district. And since very few cities can make that finding in this broad area, essentially they just can't use a big chunk of the statute. And what's happened instead is EDAs have other powers by cross-reference. You can act like an HRA, you can act like a city using your development district powers and do most of the same things. But it's created a level of confusion and an extra, it's more cumbersome because you're having to, the average person can't read the statute and understand how this is supposed to work. And it's even gone so far as the fact we've got a Court of Appeals decision from the year 2000, which was construing this provision and indicated in a footnote that this must be a typo because it said, well, this is economic development districts, they can't possibly mean redevelopment TIF. So, this is more to remove the confusion. We don't think that it changes substantively what EDAs can do. Most of their restrictions are in other statutes. If they're going to create a TIF district, it's still going to be, if it's redevelopment, the same tests. If they're going to be buying and selling land, we have lots of other rules on that. We have business subsidy law requiring public hearings. So this is really a way of streamlining and making it easier and more user-friendly for EDAs to do. With that, I would take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bubo, and thank you, Representative Lanning. Are there questions of members of the committee for either Representative Lanning or Mr. Bubo? Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, we have another testifier.
Please proceed and introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, sure. My name is Jason Arsvald. I'm the Economic and Redevelopment Director for the City of Brooklyn Park. We, too, have I'm also here representing the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, but we have, as Mr. Bubo said, had some of the same challenges with respect to this statute, generally speaking, in our practice of economic development in Brooklyn Park. More recently, we've had a specific example that in our desire to help some local businesses, especially in our economic times, undertake some economic development projects, we've been looking at ways to explore to help businesses access more capital. And the statute does provide for some of those kinds of options. However, it would require that if we were to help and do that, that those businesses would need to be located in one of these planning districts that Mr. Bubo's outlined, or an economic development district. And since we were looking at new development, new jobs, obviously the restriction on redevelopment and provisions contained within that then became very problematic for us. So while we've been able to do some of the alternative things through that authority that Mr. Bubo outlined, in this situation we just simply couldn't. And so that's why it prompted us to want to come forward and discuss this change in more detail. I'd be happy to answer any questions about
Thank you, Mr. Arvo. Are there questions of members of the committee for Mr. Arvo? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure who could perhaps answer this for me, maybe Representative Lanning. I'm maybe inferring from some of the comments that this is almost like a technical change, or as though there's kind of a redundant overlapping provision here in statute that just needs to be cleaned up. And is that really the case, or was there perhaps some original intent behind this restriction being in here that is maybe now obsolete? Or just if you could give a brief history and why this is in there in its original form.
Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I think current law results in some unintended consequences, and I think the best person to answer your question about the history of this would be Mr. Michael, who I think could much better respond to your question.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, contrary to what the Court of Appeals said, this was not a typo or an unintended mistake, but absolutely everything that Mr. Bluebell said is correct as well. This was a provision that when the Economic Development Authority law was created, which was largely at the instigation of members of the House, the Senate added this as a way that in their mind would have sort of limited the sort of the reach of the law. But of course, the fact that these agencies were also given the power of HRAs and other, I think it's mainly HRA law, they really are able to exercise most of these same powers, and it certainly doesn't have any effect on tax increment. And so it has had the effect of sort of, as they've indicated, hamstringing their operations somewhat, but probably not in the way that was intended. And so this really would be consistent with what the original intent, certainly of the proponents in the House of the EDA law was, but it's beyond being simply technical.
Representative Downey, does that cover your question? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Michael. Are there other questions for Representative Lanning or any of the testifiers? That being said, did I miss one? Representative Lanning? Oh, good. Representative Loeffler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning. I must apologize. I was at a stop by another committee before I came here, so I didn't hear all the testimony. But as I understand it, we are kind of at, now you can get around the current things by doing Housing Redevelopment Authority activities. This just makes it a more direct route. But the other route would be to narrow down the Housing and Redevelopment Authority so it really is, both of them are targeted at areas of blight. And I think there's a policy choice about, you know, when we gave these special powers and tools, that was really to enable blighted, potentially polluted areas that hadn't had the kind of maintenance that they needed, to be able to be competitive. And does the impact of your bill really, even though it makes it cleaner, has both this getting around it through the HRA, getting around the blight test, and now if we were to implement your law, do it more directly, mean that we're giving the powers of redevelopment, such as they are, to basically any plot of land, any part of the state, whether it is high need or low need, according to a standard of blight or lack of jobs or shortage of particular types of housing. And so this really is now becoming a statewide tool for all parcels of land. Is that correct?
Representative Lanning?
Well, maybe one of the testifiers want to respond to that, but let me give you an example from my community. We have an area that rental housing that is in bad shape. I think most of us would consider that to be prime for redevelopment. The current law is restricting the city from being able to do that because it doesn't quite meet the blight tests that they're required to meet now. And this change would open up for my community an opportunity to redevelop that property for better housing, much better housing than what it currently is. And so, you know, that's an example from my community that current law is preventing them from moving forward and doing the kind of redevelopment in that area that they would like to do. But Mr. Bluebell, maybe?
A follow-up on that, if Mr. Gould can answer that, but why wouldn't you do that since it is housing? Why not do it under the current Housing and Redevelopment Authority efforts rather than doing it under an EDA?
Representative Lanning.
Well, I can't speak for thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. I don't know what the city's response to that would be. They've told me that it's very difficult for them to they haven't been able to move on this under current law because of the blight requirements that are there, and I can't further respond to why they haven't pursued other avenues to make this happen.
Mr. Bluebell, did you want to address Representative Loeffler's question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. I don't think that this really is a substantive change because the legislature has already authorized quite a bit of tools to do various kinds of economic development or housing in various places. It is true that there's let me put it this way, many of the tools still require findings of blight, for example, tax increment. Most of them, either you're going to be making these same kind of findings for substandard buildings, or if it's housing, that it's for affordable housing, or there are some cases where we can do plain economic development, but with restrictions. It must be for manufacturing and warehouse, those kinds of things. So the legislature has authorized these various kinds of activities. It's just that it is more confusing and difficult, because if you're going to operate as an EDA and create this economic development district, you're so limited. You have to only do the very narrow blight focus, which is actually much narrower than it was back in 1986. And that may be perfectly appropriate as a financing tool, but as kind of a planning tool to say these are the areas within which we're going to operate, this is difficult. It's possible to work with it, because the legislature has given local authorities a good number of tools, but I think the main point is that they're confusing and cumbersome. So that's really the main. I don't think this is, it's not really substantively opening up and adding new powers.
Thank you. Are there other questions, members, for Representative Lanning or the other testifiers? Seeing none, then this being an informational hearing. And thank you for your testimony, Representative Lanning. We will take action on this, or the chair will take under consideration when we do have possession of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. The Representative Carlson, are you prepared to proceed on House File 3739? Oh, and as we do that, we do have a motion on Representative Scott's House File 3566. Representative Downey moves that bill. Chair does lay that bill over for consideration. Also on Representative Marco moves his own bill, House File 2894. Chair lays that over. Do I have a motion for the minutes from Tuesday, April 20th, 2010? Has been moved by Representative Reinert. All in favor of minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Chair moves Representative Carlson's bill. I'm sure you're an ex officio member, Representative Carlson, so.
No, I'm an official member of this
committee. Oh, I thought you were. Okay. No. There I go then. You're official member. Move your own bill, dang it.
I am ex officio on a few others, Mr. Chairman, but this one I do have a vote on.
That's it. Thank you. Representative Carlson, then to your bill, House File 3739.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, House File 3739 modifies the statutory language to increase the ongoing tax-exempt revenue bond allocation for the self-loan student loans from $10 million to $25 million each year. The increase in tax-exempt authority would improve the office's ability, that's the Higher Education Services Office, to maintain moderate interest rates for student borrowers. The SELF loan is a state-sponsored student loan program primarily for Minnesota students who need assistance paying for education beyond high school. The SELF loan is a long-term, low-interest educational loan administered by the Office of Higher Education. The SELF loan program has provided over $1.7 billion in loans to students since 1984. And I'll just footnote, back in 1984 was the author of the bill on the House side that created the self-loan program. So that dates me a little bit, but I do go back even a little earlier. The bill also authorizes state agencies receiving allocations of tax-exempt revenue bonding the authority to transfer them among the three agencies that receive allocations with the approval of the Minnesota Management and Budget. The three agencies are the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority. The amount of tax-exempt revenue bonds for mortgage bonds, public facilities bonds, residential rental bonds, and other purposes in Minnesota and other states is limited by the IRS. Minnesota's total allocation from the IRS for 2009 was $469 million. So, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the gist of the bill. In testimony earlier, and I have Mr. Mitch Gannis with the Higher Education Services Office with me if you should have questions. But at that point in time, interest was running at about 6.8% was the testimony, and currently with tax-exempt bonds, it would be 3.8%. 8%, so that would be the advantage to the students, is that they would get a much lower interest rate for the self-loan program. So do you want testimony, Mr. Chairman, or do you want to just take questions?
Go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and have him proceed. Is it Mr. Gannis or Mr. Mitch Gannis?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Mark Michikans with the Office of Higher Education. And Representative Carlson pretty much summarized the bill. I did want to emphasize two points. One is that the PC didn't talk too much about the allocation, the transfer between the agencies. It's really a management issue. Certainly there are changes in demands for housing bonds, ARB bonds, and this actually allows us to transfer authority upon agreement of each agency between ourselves. So it actually would make it more efficient process as far as using the bond authority authorized by the IRS. The second point I wanted to make, Mr. Chair, and for the members, is that we've had a number of meetings with all these agencies involved so that there's an agreement on the part of everybody on the legislation.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Carlson or the testifier? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson. I think this makes a lot of sense because these bonds do a lot of good work. I'm just wondering, as it moves forward, if you might want to have some kind of reporting back so we actually kind of know what's shifting and what parts of of these agencies are kind of not running into much demand or have demand that they can't meet, that exceeds your allocation, so that kind of would inform our allocation process as we go forward.
Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that would be a problem. We don't have language here now to do that, but being that this will be laid over and incorporated later, we can maybe ask staff to prepare language for a report back.
Thank you, Representative Carlson.
No, Mr. Chair, members, I would point out that the Department of Management and Budget does have on their website a monthly update of the allocation of the bonds between the various entitlement users, so there is some information out there right now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, how much unused bonding authority under the cap have we, quote-unquote, wasted as a result of not being able to make this kind of a transfer?
Mr. Chair,
and would you state your name again? I didn't
Mark
get it.
Michikanis,
Mr. Michikanis. Okay, thank you. Mr. Michikanis.
Mr. Chair, members, actually, the default agency is Housing Finance. If nobody else needs it, they get what's ever left. And I know that they have some relatively large programs for housing bonds that that they utilize the authority for. To the extent that they've lost some, it's canceled back because we've missed some deadlines, I'm not quite sure.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the net impact of this that our overall kind of state-level bonding authority not only goes up, but in theory we'd have debt service on the back end that would also increase as a result of this newfound bonding authority being utilized? This is going to increase our debt service obligation over the long haul.
Mr. Michikanis.
Chair and members, these are revenue bonds, tax and revenue bonds, so it really doesn't affect the state's debt service whatsoever. And this only changes the allocation. It doesn't change the overall limit.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from members of the committee for Representative Carlson or Mr. Michikanis? Seeing none, then, Chair lays the bill over. Okay, now we're on. Okay, Representative Dabney, are you ready to go on 2527?
I certainly am, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2527 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
It is so moved. Please proceed, Representative Dabney.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members, I just can't talk without a pen in my hand. I do have two handouts for the pages to distribute, I've got one and they've got the other. In your packets is an older fiscal note on this bill, which gives me the opportunity first to point out that the advocates have been working closely with the Department of Revenue on this bill, and the department significantly reduced the projected cost to the state in 1 week, and we continue to be in conversation with them. When somebody gets down here, we'll get you the other handout.
Do you have an amendment also?
I do have an amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could move the H-2527A2 amendment, the first language on lines 1.2 to 1.3 is really technical in nature, worked out with the department in terms of phrasing. Also aligns this with the Senate companion bill. And the remainder of the amendment is the oft-visited REIT language as a strategy to pay for the provision going forward.
All right, can you explain REIT, Representative Dabney?
Real Estate Investment Trust.
Thank you. Forgot that temporarily. So Representative Dabney has moved the A2 amendment. Are there any other questions from members about the A2 amendment? Seeing then, in order to get the bill in the shape the author would like, the A2 amendment is moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you.
To the bill as amendment. Did you say someone was coming down, Representative Dabney?
No, Mr. Chair, not unless there are questions. Simply put, members, in 2008, we expanded the sales tax exemption for the construction of low-income housing to include projects developed by 501c3 nonprofit corporations. Increasingly, what we've seen in just the couple of years since then is that those nonprofits are increasingly forming LLCs, as wholly owned subsidiaries, to carry out that work. Revenue has determined that even though this is what I would say a subset of that of those organizations that are doing this development, that they are not covered by the existing language for the sales tax exemption. So House File 2527, I would argue, is a technical bill that merely clarifies that if a nonprofit forms an LLC under these conditions, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of that nonprofit, that the sales tax exemption extends to that LLC as well.
Thank you. Are there questions from members for Representative Dabney to the bill as amended? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dabney, I understand the reason for the bill is to avoid, to enable them to use a different form of legal organization in order to shield them from liability claims from the housing project. What kind of liability claims would these be, related to construction, or it's related to issues to the management of that housing? What kind of liability claims were we helping shield them from?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, my understanding, and there's an asterisk there, but that my understanding is that it would be related to the construction, that the for-profit entities that have purchased the tax credits want to make sure that the construction of this project is secure and kept separate from construction of other projects that the nonprofit may also be involved in.
Representative Loeffler?
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, just to confirm, and I hope you'll follow up, that the intent is not to relieve them of any liability related to the operation of the housing project in terms of to the benefit of the tenants that they're serving there.
Representative Dabney?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler.
Any other questions for Representative Coles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, would this bill expand or contract Minnesota's tax expenditures?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, my contention is that it would do neither. That we've already identified that this is a legitimate public purpose, that the Department of Revenue has, or Management and Budget has projected that X number of units would be of low-income housing would be constructed by nonprofits, and that this merely is a change in the legal structure under which those nonprofits are carrying out that work. And in fact, the 2008, as I understand it, the 2008 fiscal note assumptions included a larger number of projects being of units being constructed than we've actually seen. So that the tax expenditure projection is actually going to be experienced as smaller.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Coles, do you have a follow-up?
Interesting, the tax expenditures we like and the tax expenditures we don't, and the loopholes we like and the loopholes we don't. And I don't have a problem with your bill, Representative Dabney. I just find the sometimes we have situational logic around here bipartisanly. I'm not suggesting that either myself or anybody on the Republican side of the aisle is immune from that. But I just find it interesting.
Representative Winchesky.
Mr. Chair, I think on that point, not exactly, but maybe Ms. Cadoon could, if you would permit her, clarify a little bit about the revenue estimate here. I watched this hearing in the Senate side, and I do think it's arguably almost technical. In fact, I called Mr. Michael this morning after watching the Senate hearing and tried to figure out if this revenue estimate could have actually been zero. But it was kind of a long, convoluted discussion. The Senate, Ms. Cadoon, I think, was helpful, and if the chair would permit her, I think it should help us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, regarding the revenue estimate, as you now have the revised estimate, we did meet with, got information from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency as well as the advocates to better understand this proposal. That's why you see it has been reduced from the original estimate. However, the information that we do have is there has been some projects, albeit very small ones, that have gone forward under the LLC formation. And so there are some projects that would have been paying sales tax that otherwise will not under this proposal, which is why you see a very small revenue estimate for this. My understanding, the sales tax is about $3,500 per unit built for low-income housing, so that's what's being exempted under this.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any questions for Ms. Cadoon or for Representative Dabney? Seeing none, then the chair lays the bill over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Why don't we do mine? Jeff.
Members, next we have Representative Lesh to present House File 3344.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move it. I do have an amendment as well prepared by Ms. Manzi. You should have in your packets that matches the amendment offered to this bill in the Senate. It specifies that 50% of the checkoff revenue goes to food shelves, 50% to homeless assistance, and provides a reference to the homeless grant program and statute under checkoff revenues and how they may be spent. It also corrects a few technical drafting errors. This is the A2 amendment in your packet.
All right. Members, I think actually this is the amendment the pages are handing out right now.
Oh, yes, I guess it's in your packet.
All right, but you've given an explanation of it. And any members have any questions about the amendment as Representative Lesh has described it?
I'm sorry, say that again, Madam Chair.
I was just asking if any members had questions about the amendment. Okay. It sounds like you just described it pretty well. So, all right, if not, go ahead and move your amendment.
I do so move, Madam Chair.
All right. Any questions, debate? All right. If not, motion is approved. Oh, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then to my bill as amended, I do have two testifiers here from whence this idea came, constituents, and I think they can probably testify to the bill as to its origins, why we want to do it, and what it can do. And I can follow up on that in terms of what exactly it does as well, Madam Chair.
All right. Very well. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Dan Kennedy, Guidance Counselor, St. Paul Johnson.
Thank you.
My name is Arthur Wynn.
2 years ago, I had four students come to see me, and they wanted to raise money and help their community. There was a homeless man in the community, and our goal was to raise $1,000. Do you want to name the students?
Well, the students are including myself, Sampoth Newell, Javen Miller Murphy, and Peng Orr.
You know, it was kind of neat because here are students trying to make a positive difference. And so I got involved as well. We spent our entire summer vacations trying to originally raise $1,000. We bagged groceries. Do you want to tell them some of the stuff
we pretty much went to houses a few days a week, soliciting for simple donations to help our cause. We had a benefit dinner, and eventually we raised over $21,000 during the entire summer.
And it was really neat. I remember one particular day we had, we were feeding the homeless too. We did a lot of things, I think, unloading pallets of food, stocking food shelves. And we realized at that time there's definitely a need in the food shelves, and they're hurting. And so many Minnesota families right now are struggling. I don't know if you saw the recent Wilder report. I think there's about a 20 26 or 27% increase in homeless Minnesotans, as well as a staggering increase in teens that are homeless throughout the state. And we see this as, you know, it's a problem within the city of St. Paul, it's a problem in Minneapolis, but it's a problem in the entire state, rural areas, suburban areas. And we view it really, and we're not here to make some kind of political statement at all. We're here to get bipartisan support for a genuine idea that Arthur and I came up with. We saw the checkoff that we currently have, and we thought, what better way to help Minnesota families and homeless people? But one day when we were feeding homeless, we got a family that came up, and she had three daughters, and I don't know their exact ages. One was a toddler. And when you saw the look in their eyes, they needed help. That family needs your help. Minnesota homeless people need your help. And struggling Minnesota families who use the food shelves to get by, they also need your help. And we're respectfully asking you to consider the merits of this genuine idea from a student and a guidance counselor. And that's how it came about.
Especially now, lots of people are hurting, families, maybe parents that may have lost their jobs, so they look to these food shelves for a temporary supply of food, maybe. And especially now, these areas are lacking supply, especially money, to pay for the food, and the demand is ever increasing. So this is a way to give people food, because no one deserves to be denied that.
And you all, I believe you Republicans and Democrats alike, have constituents who have lost their homes through foreclosures and the rising rate of unemployment. You have constituents who are impacted. This is extraordinary times right now that we're facing. That's why we can make it easy. We can make it easy for someone to donate a dollar or two. And that's why we ask for your support.
Madam Chair, I could go back through and outline what it does, but I think I explained that when explaining the amendment, and the rest of it was filled in by the testifiers here, Mr. Nguyen and Mr. Kennedy. So I guess probably the best thing now would be to stand for questions. I would note that I've been in conversations about with James Redmond about this, who represents the food shelves impacted by this, and there's some concern, obviously, about similar to the concern expressed when the constitutional amendment passed, that this would just take the place of the other appropriations that they get, and they would either lose money based on the projected revenues of this language, or it would be stagnant. So that's a concern they obviously have. We're willing to move forward and work with them on this, as is the Senate author, Anderson. That we share the same district, which is why we have this bill in their constituents. So that's why we brought this. So I guess with that, Madam Chair, other than saying that this provides a line on your tax form whereby if you want to voluntarily contribute to this, you can. Other than that, I would stand for questions.
Questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, I'm just trying to quickly look through the bill. How is the money distributed? Does it go directly to... Can you explain that a little bit more?
It specifies 50% of the checkoff revenue goes to food shelves and 50% to homeless assistance. That's how it's distributed.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, is that money, when it goes to the food shelves, is each food shelf in the state of Minnesota given an equal amount, or is it based on, you know, volume of usage at that food shelf? How is it divvied up once it gets to the food shelf itself?
Representative Lesh. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. I think the best bet would be to ask Mr. Redmond to come down and address that if he can. He knows the answer. Or someone who come down and can address that in terms of the math rubric of it.
All right, thank you. If you will please join us at the witness table and state your name for the record.
My name is Colleen Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here today. The food shelf appropriation that is currently being used in the state of Minnesota is distributed on the to all food shelves in the state of Minnesota who apply for the money, and it is issued on the use statistics, and we are the data collection organization for the state of Minnesota. It's also used for the distribution of any federal commodities or any federal monies that are distributed. So it's to all food shelves based on the numbers that they submit on a monthly basis.
Okay, great. Thank you. Follow-up? All right. Thank you. Next, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe just a quick question on the fiscal note for Mr. Michael or whomever. It shows a total cost savings dropping, quote-unquote, to the bottom line to the state. Could you explain the math and how we end up with a net put to state revenues on the fiscal note?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I think basically what those numbers are showing is the contributions that are made through the checkoff less the administrative costs. And so, I think it's basically showing that they're estimating the positive numbers are the amounts that they're actually going to get through contributions.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Downey.
So I may not be understanding this, and pardon me if this is just an elemental question, but under the Revenue Department, it seemed to me that we were already recognizing the actual cost of administering the program.
Mr. Michael.
I think if you look on the line for the Revenue Department, the line for the Revenue Department, I believe, is the cost, and the reason why it's larger in 11, which is the startup year, is that there's some initial startup costs that then decline in future years once all they're doing is the additional money that's related to the forms and so forth. So it's, if you look, there's an $88,000 cost in 11, and then it drops to $44,000 in 12 and 13.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Michael, and I just wanted to clarify kind of the accounting on the costs to the Department of Revenue. And so I look at this, and who can argue with contributing to food shelves and homeless shelters? I'm sure many of us, most of us, do similar in a direct way. And what troubles me a little bit is the additional cost overhead that we're all of a sudden attaching to these charitable contributions. I'm just doing some rough math here, and it looks like at the current cost ratios to the general fund contributions off of the checkoff, we're probably running, 12-15% of a dollar contributed is going to be absorbed by costs within the Department of Revenue. So before a dollar gets back down to a food shelter, a food shelf or a homeless shelter, we've already reduced that to whatever, 85 or 88 cents. And I'm just looking at this and thinking, boy, if I were a contributor to a charity and seeing that kind of a ratio, I'm not sure that would be up at the top of the list in terms of its efficiency. So, and this just raises a bigger point in terms of, is state government the right vehicle for distributing charity? And my overriding perspective would be we are far better going point to point as citizens directly to the charities of our choice. And while this, who can argue with the initiatives of the students and the causes that we're talking about here, I just don't know if this is the right vehicle to do this. Maybe there's a different way for the state to somehow encourage contributions to homeless shelters and food pantries other than feeling like we've got to be some kind of an administrative aggregator of contributions and then distribute it out and incur that kind of inefficiency and a lack of the dollars actually reaching the people that we're intending to help.
Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I kind of hate to even say anything, because I think it's a great cause, and I appreciate you're here. I guess I just, just want to jump in just to think about this for a little bit, and I apologize, I wasn't in the room when Representative Scott did her bill, but, my concern isn't so much that government get involved in charitable contributions, because I was just looking in the tax expenditure report, we give a $188 million tax break for charitable contributions through our charitable contribution deduction in the tax code. In 2010, it'll be $2,002,000,011, $2,007,000,011, $2,012,000,000. So, I mean, we're certainly involved in this. And arguably, a taxpayer may be better off using the personal deduction for charitable exemptions than a checkoff. But if this isn't to the cause, but my concern in seeing the fiscal note, and I see it on Representative Scott's, you know, is that we'd be carrying appropriation in the tax bill. And so, you know, generally appropriations, in my opinion, should be in finance committees, and these good causes should be authored by the chair of the housing committee or, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, I just want to say on the record, I mean, I think these are hard for members because they pull at our heartstrings and they're the right things to do from a personal perspective. On the other hand, from a tax perspective, the state of Minnesota has been diligent in not allowing these. We have the chickadee checkoff. Somehow that's withstood the test of time and arguably the campaign checkoff. But most states, I think, have a lot more. Yeah. And it does become an issue for the tax form. And I had heard that this additional or any additional for any issue, not your issue, any issue, would create the Department of Revenue creating another form because the form is getting so long. And I'm just wondering if the chair would permit Ms. Kadoon from the Department of Revenue to talk about their perspective on any checkoff. I really hate to tie it to the cause here, and I think Mr. Kennedy and the student who's testifying have really done a great job and appreciate the idea. I want to understand from the Department of Revenue's perspective what happens on the form.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Kadoon, please identify yourself and feel free to respond.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Kadoon. I'm with the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. Just to address the question of Representative Lencheski regarding our forums. Unfortunately, our forums, yes, are very crowded at this point and really don't have room to add anything. We did have in the recent jobs bill, obviously had one credit being eliminated, but we had some additional refundable credits and other credits being added. So we're kind of reviewing how we're going to be adjusting the forums currently at this point going forward. The analysis that we did for the homeless prevention credit checkoff and others indicated that the forums are so crowded that it looked like we'd have to then add another page or form to deal with even one additional credit or checkoff. So that's what the fiscal note in front of you would attest to as well. As part of the cost and ongoing cost is just because of the additional form that would be added in addition postage and etc. that goes along with having any additional forms.
Thank you.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe for Ms. Kadoon or I'm not sure who can answer this, but is the chickadee checkoff program self-sustaining? I guess again, this kind of goes to what Representative Downey was raising. I mean, we're going to bring in $300 million in 11, we're going to bring in 324 is what the revenue note says, and 350 in 2013. Yet the costs for having this program are going to exceed that, at least according to the revenue note. So there is a cost to the state general fund for this program. Is the chickadee checkoff self-sustaining? Does the department have to use part of its appropriation to fund either the instructions or the forms, or how does that work?
Ms. Kadoon?
Madam Chair, Representative, for the chickadee checkoff, currently that raises it's been about $1 million annually that raises, and that dollar amount stayed fairly consistent over the years. The number of returns, just to give you a little background on that, I think is about 2.6% returns right now do the checkoff for that one. I think the high point was around 3%. We do just get a general fund appropriation for any of our administrative costs, so we don't get so it's just funded from our general fund administrative costs that would fund any kind of the ongoing forms, etc., just dealing with that one. Checkoff. Unless I'm reading the fiscal note incorrectly. I don't think I am. The cost, my understanding, the cost to the Department of Revenue is about $88,000 for the first year, and then it goes down to $44,000, et cetera. So what was being for the revenue estimate shows is that what they expect to occur under the revenue estimate is it would raise about $300,000 in the first year, and then it would be a slight uptick after that. So it should, at this point, raise more than it would cost us for the administration of it.
Well,
Representative Coles?
Madam Chair, Ms. Cadoon, or Representative Lesh, I mean, as I understand the bill, that which is raised by the checkoff would be distributed out, and that's how the revenue note, that's how the fiscal note appears to read. So if we raise $300 million on the checkoff, we're going to distribute $300 million, and there's administrative costs that are either going to need to be appropriated to the department or eaten by the department. We're going to make you eat the cost of this. One way or the other. We're raising more money than we're spending, to be sure, but we're appropriating out to the food shelves and to the homeless shelters whatever's collected, if I'm reading this correctly.
Ms. Cadoon?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, yes, you're correct. I'm sorry, I was looking more at the net cost. Obviously, the cost would be to the general fund from the Department of Revenue under this bill currently, whereas the dollars then are distributed out to the food shelves and homeless.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, and I had two amendments here. One was to avoid being in a money laundering scheme here. We're at A5, an amount sufficient to pay the personnel administrative costs, Department of Revenue, was appropriated out of the management account. But with the new amendment I received from Nina Manzi, I thought that this had incorporated it. It didn't. That's my intention. But because of the phrasing of the new amendment, I think it didn't go on. And I don't know if I could still add this to avoid that problem, but taking into consideration that it was added in the Senate and this bill is being laid over, that being the intention, I'm not going to clutter up the committee with adding it now. That being said, that's the intention, Representative Coles.
Thank you. I have Representative Downey and Representative Reinert on the list. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to respond to the comment that we expend $180 million on the charitable contributions deduction. I mean, there is a huge difference, and we can get back into the same old discussion that we've had numerous times here, but allowing people to hold on to $180 million of their money that was charitably contributed is totally different than the state processing this fund and distributing the funds itself and incurring the administrative overhead of doing it. And I see it as an incredibly inefficient way to route money from very charitable individuals to the people who actually need the help.
Thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess first I'll just respond to Representative Downey's point. I don't disagree where you've been going with your comments on this. I do just want to, you know, at the fear of getting us into the whole expenditures conversation again, you know, when someone gets that $180 million expenditure, someone else is picking up the bill. And I mean, we can have, and I'm happy to have a bigger conversation about expenditures in general. I think we have too many. I'd love to get rid of a lot of them and be more honest about it. If these are the things we want, then we ought to pay for them in an equal and fair manner. So I do appreciate where you're going with this. And just a minor thing for, you know, I know a lot of folks listen to us on the web and they watch the follow-up. You know, for folks that don't know, Chickadee Checkoff is the non-game wildlife checkoff. So that's just a little legislative speak we should clear up. But Ms. Cadoon, while you're there, early in the session, was going down the road of an idea of a local government checkoff. I had folks that were, you know, and I guess I could have written a bill and submitted it and kind of along the Representative Scott bill and made it the I don't want to lose my library and local park checkoff. And I decided not to because the commissioner and I met and talked about it, and he gave me the information similar to what you just said about the form becoming more lengthy and needing more space and the pure production cost of an even lengthier form. But he also stressed sort of a, I don't know if I want to call it philosophical, but maybe just an administrative position of not wanting to be the arbitrators of everybody's project going on to the tax forms. And
I just want to, am I sort of framing that correctly? Is there sort of a department stance on checkoffs in general?
Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, Representative Reinhart, the department's obviously been concerned just for the checkoffs because a lot of states, when they have done this, they have then added many checkoffs. For Missouri, for example, has 18 checkoffs. Just many states, just as once they seem to have added more than one, just didn't kind of know the cutoff point. And I think just for the simplicity of the forms and confusion of the taxpayers, I think that's more from the department's concern is that once you start adding on, that it's hard to then, seems to be hard to stop for some legislators.
Representative Lincheski.
Madam Chair, can I ask Mr. Michael, just Representative Reiner made me think of something, because I think, you know, people can always give more money to government if they want. I mean, you can just write a bigger check, you know, and government will take it. But can I ask Mr. Michael, I'm just trying to remember, when I was elected the year Governor Ventura was, and I don't remember if it was the first year, but somewhere in there, he, I believe, promoted a, and maybe passed, I don't think he passed, but promoted a, you can check off more for a stadium. I think what he was trying to prove the point was that nobody wanted to fund a stadium. I'm just wondering if Mr. Michael can remind us if that was a checkoff move.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, no, it was not. Governor Ventura simply set up a fund for the stadium and announced that, you know, the state would accept contributions and keep them in this fund. And, of course, the state, as you indicated, accepts contributions anytime anyone wants to make them to it. And I guess another point that's worth pointing out is for someone who checks off under one of these checkoff provisions, those contributions do in fact qualify for the charitable contribution deduction. And so if you do the non-game wildlife checkoff and you keep track of that, you can then deduct that. And so this, you know, it's not what we think of as a tax expenditure. I think Representative Downey is characterizing it correctly. The state is acting as like a conduit for these contributors. But when you do contribute that way, if you otherwise meet the criteria for taking a deduction, you will qualify and it will trigger a tax expenditure.
Madam Chair,
Representative Lincheski.
And I think that is a good, I didn't know that, and I think that's an interesting thing to point out, and I guess, you know, this is an appropriation. It isn't a tax expenditure. I agree. My point is only that government is in the business of heavily preferring and giving tax breaks for charitable deductions. It is not silent on the act of giving charitable contributions in the tax expenditure book. But I think this is both an appropriation and you get a tax deduction for it too now, which I didn't realize that. I just think it's really interesting. Interesting discussion.
Right. I think Mr. Kennedy, one of our witnesses, wanted to comment.
Make a comment. There are a lot of lower-income people, middle-income people, who do not have tax attorneys. They can't afford tax attorneys. They're not going to be taking deductions on this. They want to give a dollar or two. You know, and I think everyone and a lot of people here may see the merit in this idea or not. But if you look at it and get convoluted into all the technicalities and so forth, we lose the point. Do we want to help people? Do we value game and wildlife above our human resources? Our natural resources are the only thing as a state we'll have a checkoff for, but not our human resources? If that's what you're saying, then I think your constituents should know that as well.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is it Mr. Kennedy? Is
that right? Yes.
And Mr. Kennedy, you know, I appreciate your comments. We spend a lot of time on this committee. If you had the misfortune of having to sit through each and every one of our committee hearings, you'd quickly learn that this committee is very good at spending a lot of time down in the weeds. And it is important because, you know, how we administer our tax system here in Minnesota, even on things that we may agree are good ideas, you know, it's important how we administer them. And I don't think anybody, you know, here thinks that we shouldn't be doing more individually to help food shelves and homeless shelters. But I guess I just want to ask one more question of Ms. Cadoon, and I wasn't here. I apologize when Representative Scott had her bill, and I know this is a this is the Revenue Committee, not the Appropriations Committee, but I'm just curious, Ms. Khadun, as I look at the revenue or the fiscal notes, I see that on Representative Scott's bill, the department is estimating in fiscal year 11 a half-time FTE, and in 12 and 13 two-tenths of an FTE. And on the Lesh bill, we've got one-tenth of an FTE for, I think, what's... So I'm curious, what's the distinction? Why... does the department like one better than the other, and that's why they said, is one going to be harder to administer than the other? I'm curious what the difference is there, and why we're... what's going on?
Ms. Khadun.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I apologize. I actually haven't seen the fiscal note for the general fund one, so I would be similar to you and question why we'd have a difference on that. So I will certainly look into that a little further.
Thank you.
So Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I wasn't especially happy with the comment of one of the people up there that said that basically we're more interested in wildlife than people. I don't think that's got anything to do with it, and that's kind of not where most of us are, and to label us that I think is really improper. The one thing got on, and I thought there was pretty much a agreement not to go further, and I think this is a good, you know, a very worthy cause. There were a lot of other worthy causes, and maybe the chair can answer. We had this maybe 3 years ago. We had early in session some bills like this, and I and others had bills immediately afterwards, and I have no idea how many dozen bills were there, and I thought there was a pretty strong direction from the chair that we're not going to do this. Otherwise, and that's why I haven't put in any of my bills for, you know, I may think they're just as worthy a cause as this. This is a very worthy cause, but maybe to the chair, where are we going with this? Can we now put in bills? Because I didn't do that because I had pretty much a pretty strong direction not to do that, so.
Representative Winchesky, would you like to respond?
Sure. Thank you, ma'am. You know, I did tell authors if they paid for their bills, we'd hear them, and we're hearing them. Doesn't mean we're doing them. I'll just be honest about that. But the committee itself, you know, can always offer the amendment, and if it goes on, you know, then it passes. But I think, you know, your recollection is right, Representative Mueller. We tried to sort of stop when we were hearing all the bills without people having to pay for them, sort of all these checkoffs and all these initiatives. And I'll say, you know, and Representative Mueller has been on the committee with me, bipartisanly, people have not done these in the House under Chair Krenke, Chair Abrams, myself. And that's been kind of a bipartisan agreement because people understand them to be appropriations that are not being done in the finance committees. They're being done here. And then I think there's the other just plain old problem, as I think Mr. Kennedy pointed out, you know, you're on a tax form sort of preferring, you know, if we had this, we'd have a couple. But, you know, then why not K-12 and why not transportation and why not whatever? So, you know, I do think the problem with them, and it's not this issue, is everybody thinks of, you know what, I have a good cause too and I need a checkoff. And so I think it wouldn't take long to have 20 checkoffs, as Ms. Khadun stated, other states do. So, you know, this committee this year may change its mind and pass one of these out, but it has been, just so folks know, historically the House has not done these sort of bipartisanly. So.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, I have just kind of a different direction of a question for you. Have you heard from the tax preparers any opinion on this bill at all, or have they given you any feedback at all on the legislation?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. No, I haven't heard anything from them. But I'm sure they consider it a jobs bill, Representative Anderson.
That's your theme today, isn't it?
All right, Ms. Khadun, it looks like you may have some new information for us. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just they handed me the fiscal note, and we discussed back there a little bit. It looks like it probably was just a typo on the FTE between the one fiscal note and the other ones. If you look at the dollar amounts, they're exact same dollar amount and exact same cost. So I think the fiscal note for the FTE would probably be more similar, or should be the same probably as the homeless checkoff.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. Any other questions from members? All right, Mr. Kennedy, go ahead. You have
just
something
a
else?
Quick comment, if I may. And again, you may view it as this will open the floodgates and so on. I think there's nothing more important than you can do, you know, than this. And if it opens the floodgates, I would guess with all of your expertise and professionalism and experience that you will be able to draw the line after the two most important checkoffs, okay, which would be the DNR checkoff and the food shelves checkoff here. I think as a committee, you have the expertise to know where to draw that line. And we're asking you, Arthur Wynn and myself, to draw the line here and to really consider this. And is it a good bill or not? If it is a good bill and a good idea, then I think you should vote yes, and I think you should add it to the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
All right. Representative Lesh, any final comments?
Well, I think they summed it up adequately. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Well, I would like to thank Mr. Kennedy and your students for all of your hard work and your dedicated effort on this. And with that, we will hold House File 3344 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, not a fun place.
No.
And you know what? You can't do something that don't like that. On the other hand, you said it perfectly. Oh, it worked. He wanted to see him. He was trying to
see
it.
Clips of Mulley, are you prepared to proceed on Senate File 1126? Okay, good. So,
hand it off.
Okay, so Representative Mulley moves that Senate File 1126 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Mulley, you have a first motion that the House language be reinserted into Senate File 1126.
Yes,
is that correct?
Chairman.
Okay. Okay, pages are passing out the House language, so why don't we sit tight until people get to read it before we vote on it. How's that?
Mr. Chairman, we could probably start describing it.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and start explaining what it's going to do then, Mr. Mulley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Basically, the use deeds section of the statutes was passed in 1941. There's been very little changes, and it hasn't been updated, so it isn't working very well. The department ends up now trying to get into litigation to enforce the use deeds. What it is when there's tax forfeit, the land goes to the state, and then they give a deed back to the city or local government, and right now there can be classification, for instance, for public purpose or for parklands, and they've ended up with a number of lawsuits. The last thing we need is Department of Revenue ending up on lawsuits as to exactly what is a park use and things like that all over the state. So they've been working on this almost 4 years to try and get buy-in from everybody, and they finally reached something that everybody can agree with. And the process will clear up the definitions. It will also have a medium ground, which is like blighted property, which the city can get for a smaller than a full market value. It also puts in a reverter clause that it terminates after 30 years rather than permanent as now. And basically, those are the generalizations of it. And Jason will explain it more in detail.
Roy, please introduce and state your name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Jason Nord. I work with the Department of Revenue. There is a one-page handout that I'm not sure if it's gotten around yet that kind of tries to tackle this in a clean one-page form, because it is somewhat of an obscure topic. It's essentially dealing with how tax forfeited land is sold, and specifically how local governments can acquire it. And other than buying this property for full market value, a local government can acquire a use deed where if they pledge it to a specific use, they can get it for free, but it comes with the condition of a reversionary clause. And as Representative Mulry said, the law hasn't changed much since 1941 when it was enacted, and it's very unclear as to what the intent of the law is in this day and age compared to maybe what they were facing in 1941. And so the many problems of the current law structure are summarized on the handout with the corollary proposed solution. So the first problem is this notion that there's an infinite use contingency that we can monitor forever into perpetuity whether the property is compliant with its deed. So to solve that, we've included the 30-year expiration on the reverter, and we've allowed compliant use deeds to be exchanged for quick claim deeds. Again, the unclear intent and the meaning of authorized public use is not clear, and we seek to clarify it. We're clarifying it by providing some greater contextual definition that use deeds are better for uses that allow the public to physically use and enjoy property. And so we've enumerated the public uses that qualify for a use deed. And one example is parks. And one of our recent court rulings has cast some confusion as to what is considered a park. The court basically ruled that since there's no state statutory definition, however the city defines a park in its code or charter is the definition that we should use. And so we're in a situation of having to look city by city how they define a park as to whether or not they're in compliance with a use deed. And as Representative Mulry has said, the lack of alternatives is also a problem, where it's either you buy it for full price or you get it for free, but you have these restrictions. It's created a lot of incentive to abuse the use deeds. So we've created several new alternatives that better fit the circumstances. There's free acquisition for developer outlots that were meant to go to the city but forfeited prior to being conveyed, and similar parcels for common interest communities. And there are some reduced price options for uses that where there may be a market failure, like correcting blight or developing greater affordable housing, or if cities and towns want to preserve wetlands or plan for stormwater and drainage, or preserving land in its natural state. It's better to serve those purposes through reduced price sale of quitclaim deeds rather than through the use deed as an option. We've also clarified some of the processes surrounding these types of deeds. The way tax forfeited lands are classified has been fixed, whereas currently it's up to the city or town to approve the classification, and then there can be a stalemate when they do not approve the classification. We've instead created more of a meeting and input structure into the classification process. And we've also clarified the process by which land can be withheld from sale when a local government is interested in acquiring it. We've also repealed one of the bigger problems with current law, which is something that allows a sale under Chapter 469 to qualify as meeting your use restriction. So right now, under current law, if we issue a use deed for a park and then the city sells that park under Chapter 469 to be developed into housing, we have to continue to look at that parcel as if it's being used as a park. And it just doesn't seem like the appropriate mechanism for transferring title to property. We've also clarified many numerous miscellaneous issues. We've worked with a number of groups over the last 3 years on this. At the present time, we're not aware of anyone who's opposed to the bill. Everyone we've engaged is either supportive or neutral on it. And it was able to pass through the Senate with a unanimous vote, and we hope to see good support from the House as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mulry?
Mr. Chairman, one other point that I put in was just to protect owners around one of these parks, we put in a notice to, I think it's anybody within 400 feet, if the city plans to change it from a park to some other use.
Thank you, Representative Mulry. Now, we do have the House language that needs to be reinserted, so just to cover all our bases, I think we need a motion to do that. Representative Mulready moves that the language of House File 1395 be inserted into the Senate file language, or which we're doing, which is the Senate file number on that again? Under 112, Senate File 1126. All in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Now, you have an amendment, the A4 amendment, and I did not necessarily hear this specific change in that, so if you can just briefly explain what that does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that technically where we said targeted neighborhood, that's now referred to a believe targeted community in the statute, so we just have to comply with that.
Okay. All in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Then I believe you explained everything in Mr. Nord. Was it Mr. Nord?
Nord.
Nord.
Yep. How do you spell it?
N-O-R-D.
Oh, there we go. Mr. Nord, yes. I had it. Mr. Any other questions of members of the committee for Mr. Nord or Representative Mulready to the bill as committed? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulready, the Senate version passed unanimously. I'm curious what the need for replacing that bill with the House language, what are the major differences?
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, when originally the first engrossment of the House was of the House bill was supposed to be the bill, the language that they took up in the Senate, but when the Senate committee that passed it onto the floor took the House language to draft it, whoever authored that made some very minor technical changes to the language, like changing the word prior to before in a few spaces. So there was just some very little drafting stylistic changes. So the only real significant issue is this amendment to correct the references to targeted neighborhoods, to targeted communities.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either for Representative Mulready or Mr. Nord, I just want to be clear on Section 5, the reverter language. If a local government has a plan for the use of the land, it won't automatically revert, correct? I mean, I'm reading this in the bill brief, and I didn't get a chance to look and actually find the language in the bill, but the bill brief says, clarifies that there is no failure to put the land to use and no abandonment if that use is contained in a formal plan of that local government. So I wanted, A, know that that's correct, and B, what would the administration's definition of a formal plan be?
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair and Representative Reiner, that language is on the, at least the Senate language that was passed out, starts on line 9.9 through 9.12. So that it is indeed in the bill. One of the things that we were running into, for example, is a parcel would be acquired for a bicycle trail, but they were still in the mode of acquiring all the parcels they needed, and so it wasn't actually a bike trail yet. And instead of reverting the property back to the state and having them reacquire it through another use deed, we've just said that, I don't know what the exhaustive list of formal plans are, but we'd be thinking if it's in a comprehensive plan or a capital improvement plan or some sort of formal plan by a local government, then we would be satisfied at the three-year mark anyway.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Chair. I guess good. Yeah, I mean, you got at the point. I was concerned that, you know, only a comprehensive land use plan or only some certain document was going to be defined as the formal document when, you know, larger communities like mine have many neighborhood plans and different things that have been led by a consultant and vetted by neighborhood gatherings, and what I'm hearing is that those would be valid.
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhart, that's correct. You know, as long as it's a formal plan that someone's voted on or adopted, or I think we'd be satisfied.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Nord and Representative Mulready. I serve on the Cultural and Outdoor Finance Committee, and I've learned a lot about all the different classifications of land related to habitat, parks, scientific and natural areas, wildlife areas, state conservation areas. There are more definitions than I ever even knew existed, and I think that the definitions that you have here are going to run into some of the same problems that we've had in that committee as we've tried to figure out which component of the legacy funds what goes into the Parks and Trails Fund versus what goes into the Habitat Fund. And I think that we might want to have some of our house research environment people look at these definitions. What we've learned, for example, like if you think of the Three Rivers Parks, which operate parks in, I think it's 11 counties now in the metro area. I don't know. They keep adding on how many they're doing it under contract. And they have, like, some gigantic areas that we all in the metro area call them parks. But they might have 5,000 acres that maybe has a cross-country trail through it, but it really is natural wildlife habitat. If it was in greater Minnesota, it would be called a scientific and natural area. And so there's real tension points. And since you're some things here, you don't have to pay for it if you declare it a park, but if you are going to maintain it in a natural state, you do have to pay for it. I just think there's going to be some issues that are going to be raised here just because what seems like, if you're from a Minneapolis person like you and I are, represent Mallory, are much cleaner, you start to realize that those same words that we use have a very different meaning to people in other parts of the state or within the Department of Natural Resources. And so I just think we may need to do some clarifying language related to those types of properties, because it's more complicated than I had thought as well.
I'll just take that as a comment unless one of you wants to be heard on it. Yeah. Mr. Nord?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, those are exactly some of the issues that current law is causing us to wrestle with. And we deliberately avoided trying to specifically define park in this language. Instead, what we're trying to make clear is that only those parks that are available to and accessible by the public, so it can't be surrounded by private property, but it must be available to and accessible by the public, and it must contain some amenities such as campgrounds, playgrounds, athletic fields, trails, or shelters. And the point that our decision rule on what qualifies for a use deed is it truly a place where the public can come and enjoy and utilize the property, or is it just land being set aside for some other good purpose? And so, yes, we've been dealing with that problem under current law. We think we're taking a step forward, but there for sure will still be some gray areas, I'm sure, that we'll encounter.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. North, Representative Mallory, page 7, line 23, we still have the word neighborhood. That community as well, and that wasn't included in your menu. It says conveyance targeted neighborhood lands. Do you want targeted community lands? I just happened to notice that.
Who's reading
the bills? He's actually reading
the bills. I'm not going to be consistent with the years.
Straight neighborhood. 7.3. Representative Carlson, were you referencing 7.3 in the inserted house language?
Line 7.23, subdivision 1B, it says conveyance, targeted neighborhood lands, and Representative Mallory with this amendment in the paragraph, struck neighborhood and included inserted community. And I just wondered if it needed to be consistent.
Representative Mallory?
Mr. Chairman, it's fine to do that, and Mr. Michael could also, I believe that the reviser would probably automatically do that, but it doesn't matter either way.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mallory is correct that the reviser has, this is a head note, and the reviser can always change head notes, but the legislature could change it as well, so it's, either way.
Mr. Carlson?
I'll move that we strike on line 7.23, the word neighborhood, and insert community.
Representative Carlson moves on line 7.23, the word neighborhood is struck, and the word community.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dowdy?
Mr. Chairman, my major amendment for the day.
He's running on that.
Oh, your re-election amendment.
That's his election, Tim.
That amendment, I say to Representative Dowdy?
And Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that same change might need to be made on 7.29.
Other election.
That's
right there.
That's in.
There you go. Oh, sorry. Pardon me. Thank you.
That's why I raised the question. Thank you. You've already done it.
Roger. Okay, so to the amendment as stated, inserting the word community for neighborhood in line 7.23, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you for your keen eye, Representative Carlson. Then to the bill as amended, any other questions by members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping perhaps House staff could go a little bit over what leads to tax forfeited land in the first place, if you can speak to that a little bit for me.
If Mr. Maybe that question could be better targeted to Mr. Nord, Representative Anderson. Mr. Nord, can you speak to that?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, when a taxpayer does not pay their property taxes, that's starts the forfeiture process. And so there are some protections for taxpayers where they have some time to be able to pay their taxes. But if they do not take advantage of those opportunities to redeem their property, then the property does go forfeited to the state. And that's when this whole process starts, where the county then must classify that forfeited parcel as either a conservation parcel that the county is going to maintain, or whether it's a non-conservation parcel that they'll make available potentially to sell or for local governments to acquire. And so all of these reforms deal with it from that point on, of how local governments can acquire that tax forfeited land. But the land becomes tax forfeited by failure to pay property taxes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Nord, can you tell me what is the length of time and what is the notification process for the property owner that they are delinquent in paying their taxes?
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'm not completely the expert on that. I believe there's a 3-year period for commercial and a 5-year period for residential.
Is it 7?
Seven. A 7-year period for residential property. I guess I'm not. It'd be better if we brought maybe Department of Revenue Legal Counsel down if you have further questions about notice. And
just yes, Mr.
Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, unless you want it to be addressed by House Research Staff.
It doesn't matter to me who addresses it.
Ms. Baker?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Can you speak into the mic? Ms. Baker?
It's 7 years in the case. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's 7 years in the case of. Of residential, ag, timber. I think it's basically kind of splits by commercial is 3 years and the other is 7. And it basically goes through a process. But what I was going to say is a lot of what the Department of Revenue is dealing with are all of these hundreds of parcels and maybe even thousands of parcels statewide that have been out there tax forfeited for years and years, and they're just trying to do something with them and get a handle on them and have the reverter clause step in so that they don't have to continually look at all these deeds and with the quick claim deeds. And so I think a lot of it is trying to clean up the past and then to move on. Because, you know, I don't think from year to year we have a lot of tax forfeited parcels, because property either... If a person doesn't pay their property taxes, somebody else tries to step in, be it a friend or neighbor or whatever, because if property is worth very much, you know, people aren't going to lose it for the property tax on it. So this is much more as a back kind of clean up all of these parcels that the Department of Revenue is trying to deal with than almost, you know, and then have a process for going forward. But it's a lot more of that back.
Okay. So to this point, Representative Reiner?
To this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to back up staff's comments. You know, on the council, and I don't know that this necessarily comes up as often as the metro area as it does in greater Minnesota, but especially in northern Minnesota, we have parcel after parcel that, like in my city, were literally platted by people on the East Coast who had never set foot in town. And then someone bought these parcels, got to Duluth, found out there was a 20% grade and it was rock, you know, from having gone to school there, and said no thank you and just walked away from it. And so it ended up tax forfeiture now being managed by the county. And, you know, some of it may never change out of that status, but over time some of it does as a project comes along or we find some new use for it. And then we've gone through hoop after hoop after hoop to try and clean that history up and get it back into productive use. So. I appreciate all the work that's been done here, because I know it'll make the lives of local elected officials a little bit easier.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly recognize the importance of doing this, and I think this is a good step. And I guess what I just had one question and then a comment. But on a just as a general rule, what is the delinquent tax amount as it relates to the value of the property? I mean, is there any kind of a rule of thumb there that kind of characterizes the properties we're talking about here?
Mr. Nord, can you answer that, or do you got a phone a friend?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, I don't think anyone at the department can answer that question because we don't actually get the information about what the tax was owed when it becomes forfeited. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure I can call anyone down to answer that question.
Okay, there would be interesting to kind of thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be interesting to kind of know. I guess the piece that I think would really make this a much better approach is it seems like everything in here is kind of greasing the skids for all of these properties to become under the purview of government. And I guess I would like to see a policy that would make the first priority get this land back in private hands to somebody that will develop it and pay taxes on it. I mean, I guess I just think that's a much higher priority that I would like to see in our policy as a state of doing this. I think this does some things to help us move us to a better place than we are now, but I think in general, as I look through it here, there's just a lot of benefits that government gets that a private party would not get if they were going to buy the land and try and redo it.
Representative Mulray, why don't you address that point, and then if there are no other questions, why don't you make closing statements to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland. Actually, this goes a lot in that direction because we now have reduced price options and several things in there. If you look at this box, so it's an advantage to getting that done now, and it's
absolutely. I mean, I recognize this is definitely an improvement. It's moving in the right direction. Yeah. But I said I would like to see it go a lot farther in that direction.
Thank you, Representative Mulray. Any other closing comments,
Mr. Chairman? I think it's been thoroughly discussed.
Well, Representative Mulray renews his motion. Oh, that's right. My spidey senses tell me there might be public testimony on this bill. Are they wrong? They are wrong. First time today. Representative Mulray renews his motion that Senate File 1126 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Then, Representative Lucheski, any announcements or anything? Nothing. Committee is adjourned.